Chris Boyd. Up next on Think, how the world might work when cars do the driving for us. We'll spend this hour with planning consultant Anthony M. Townsend, who's been closely monitoring the development of autonomous vehicles and other artificial intelligence technologies to help companies and governments get ready for a radically different future. We'll talk about why driverless vehicles will come in far more varieties than the cars, trucks, and vans we have now, about how their ability to deliver stuff will change more than their ability to move people, and about why this new form of transit will radically change not just how we do things, but where. Our conversation starts after a short break. From now, if you pull up an app to get a ride to work, there's a good chance that the vehicle that shows up for you won't have anybody behind the wheel. Once you're at the office, maybe you'll summon a robot circulating the building to fetch your lunch from the corporate cafeteria and deliver it to your desk. A few years after that, even if you live in your city's most densely populated area, you might enjoy a stroll or bike ride through streets that are largely free of auto traffic. Autonomous vehicles are our future, and they will change just about everything. From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. Anthony M. Townsend earns his living helping governments, companies, and innovators plan for this new era as founder of a consulting firm called Star City Group. As he explains in his new book, letting computers and robots take over moving people and things may solve some problems and create others. It will also reshape how, when, and where we do things. The book is called Ghost Road, Beyond the Driverless Car. Anthony, welcome to Think.
Hi, Chris. How are you?
Very well, thanks. So you remind us that the move from using horses to get around to using cars actually represented a kind of loss of brain power to assist us in transportation. Animals contributed a certain amount of knowledge and skill in navigating that cars do not possess.
Yeah, it was actually quite common before the automobile for people traveling on horseback and even wagon and cart drivers to fall asleep. And let their animals simply follow the road, or follow the wagon, the rut, down the road or across the prairie, until they woke back up or they reached the end of the road or they found something, along the way to nibble on. And it was perfectly safe because the animal was its own, self-driving vehicle.
But doze off in a car you're driving yourself, and within seconds you can be in really serious trouble.
Right. So very early on, in the automobile revolution, as early as the 1920s, you start to see this kind of society-wide search for a technology that will allow for some level of automation in driving. And in fact, that's because we've automated vehicles going back in all of human history. Sailors have rigged all kinds of contraptions using ropes and rudders and things, weather vanes, to automate the steering of ships going back thousands of years. And if you look at like every mythic tradition on the planet, there's a hero or a god or some kind of figure who is getting about on, a chariot or a ship or a throne that drives itself around. And so this is kind of like one of our oldest technological longings. And it was the incredible speed and weight and destructive power of the automobile that really kicked it into high gear. And, every decade since in the 20th century, we've seen different attempts and inventions and technologies to try to address this problem. And only very recently have we been able to summon the kind of power to actually to make it feasible.
Is it reasonable to expect that if we are all using driverless vehicles, we'll be safer on the roads than when we're all using our own brains to drive?
So that's the big promise. And a lot of what I was trying to do in the book was to examine what are the promises of self-driving vehicles that have been put out there. And this October, actually, we're coming up on the 10th anniversary of the announcement of what was then Google's secret self-driving car project in October 2010. And this was really, I think, when the kind of pitch for automated vehicles got into the public limelight very clearly. You know, it was a big high profile project from a company that at the time was still quite well regarded by a lot of people. The whole techlash hadn't happened yet. And the car companies were crawling their way out of bankruptcy post-recession. And so there was, you know, real optimism. Safety was the number one benefit. Google demonstrated the self-driving car, you know, being not being driven by, but operating with, you know, visually impaired people, with children inside of it, you know, people who would never be able to drive or operate a conventional motor vehicle. And the idea was that, you know, it remove all human decision making and potential for error. And there were a lot of misleading statistics thrown around. So safety was one big myth. Another was that we'd get rid of traffic forever. And then the third was that we would extend mobility to all the people that had been left behind by the automobile. And so a lot of what I tried to do is really examine these and find out, you know, whether the self-driving car could actually deliver those, and whether automation in general might deliver other kinds of mobility other than cars that could actually achieve some of these things.
I was really stunned to read that market analysts think most taxi services, at least in the industrialized world, will be automated within 10 years. I mean, I've got T-shirts in my closet that I've had for more than 10 years. It doesn't seem that far into the future. How might a preponderance, if not a majority, of taxi bots change the way we think about driving?
Yeah, so, I mean, Google, through its spinoff Waymo, has already launched a fully operational, fully automated taxi, self-driving taxi service in the Phoenix area that's on its way to like 10,000 vehicles that you can go. And, you know, as you described in your lead into the show, you know, you don't have to wait 10 years. You can go to Phoenix now and press a button on your phone, and that fully automated Chrysler Pacifica minivan will come and pick you up, and there's no one inside. There's somebody remotely monitoring it, but you know, and once that trial, you know, really proves itself, probably in the next, you know, year or so, that's going to start to get scaled out. It's going to trigger other companies, investors to enter the marketplace, and that transition, once it takes place, will really, really happen very quickly. And it's going to be, I think, how most people experience this technology for the first time. There's not a lot of people lining up at dealer showrooms, you know, demanding self-driving cars. We're going to experience this, you know, when we go to a resort, like a Disney resort, or when we step out of an airport in Orlando or Las Vegas, and we're on vacation and our guard is lowered, and we say, you know what? Yeah, we'll hop into a self-driving taxi and try this for the first time. For now as well, because of the way the sensors work on these technologies, they're primarily a sunbelt technology. You know, they require good weather. They require sort of spacious, modern street grids that have clear road markings. I live in New Jersey, and, you know, we love to joke that we'll be the last state to get self-driving cars because we have these things called jug handles, which are these, you know, weird intersections that were popular in the 1920s for some reason. So, you know, there's a lot of parts, you know, there's other parts of the Midwest that I think snow is going to be a long standing barrier to the technology. They'll have to invest in infrastructure that allows the vehicles to sort of be guided along the road. So it's going to take time, but I think taxis are one area. And then the other area where we'll see these roll into our lives very quickly is in delivery. I wrote a lot about in the book about, you know, one of the other big myths of driverless vehicles is that they're about changing how we get around. And the real need for them right now, even before COVID and before the shutdowns, was for adding capacity and reducing the cost of delivering stuff we buy online. You know, Amazon spends $3 to $4 for every package they ship to your house, and they're losing money on that. They really need to bring that cost down, almost, you know, 90%. And the only way they're going to do that is through automation. Because of the what's happening to retailing now, because of the pandemic, we're going to see that change just, you know, boost into a light speed transition. And I expect, you know, the next year or two, we're going to see all kinds of automated vehicles bringing packages, rolling down our street at all hours of day, because these things, you know, don't have to live on our schedule.
One of the things you describe is each block or a couple of blocks would have, say, a dedicated Amazon vehicle that serves as a locker. And when you get home from work or wherever you've been, you walk down to that locker and unlock your package and walk it back to your house.
So that's one possible model. I think, you know, most of our lifetime, the way we get things delivered is essentially, you know, the same. It's a parcel service, which is a business model that was invented over 100 years ago. You know, a van runs a daily route around the city or a neighborhood, and you get one set of deliveries a day, and that's it. We have all different kinds of delivery services we want now. We have stuff, you know, bulk orders that we just need them to come every week, but it's okay if they come a day early or a day late. We have stuff we want to order and have it the next day. We have stuff that, you know, we want immediately, like food and other kinds of instant delivery items. We have far more returns than we ever had before, because online retailers are changing that relationship with customers. I mean, Amazon, something like 25 to 35% of apparel that's bought on Amazon gets returned. Mm-hmm. So people are essentially, you know, treating Amazon like a department store, and their home is the dressing room, and they're taking clothes and trying them on and sending them back. And Amazon's building a business model around that. That requires a totally different set of services and vehicles. So one option might be a concept automated vehicle that was designed by IDEO in California that they call the Mule. And a Mule basically takes a day's worth of deliveries for a neighborhood or even for a large building in a city. It rolls in the morning, it parks and turns into a package locker. You go get your stuff, you drop your returns, and at the end of the day, it shuttles back to the depot. That can potentially take dozens of trucks off the street, reduce traffic, reduce carbon footprint. It makes things much more convenient for people who don't have to lug packages back and forth and leave notes for the pickup and the drop-off. And it saves lots and lots of money for the companies that are shipping and bringing these items back. So I think we're going to see lots and lots of different experiments as these companies try to figure out how to move all this material quickly and cheaply and now safely, because there's increased demand for having a lot of that be contactless.
I think already some people struggle with buying too much because it's so very convenient to order something with a click and have it show up on your doorstep, you know, maybe 2 hours later or at most a couple days later. Will we have to be careful about overconsumption in this new era?
This is where I think things are going to get very, very complicated, particularly if you care about the impacts of your consumption, right? It is actually, in almost every case, much lower carbon impact for you to buy something online and have it delivered by any kind of vehicle, even if it's a dirty, stinky 20-year-old UPS diesel delivery van. If it's an electric van, much better. And there's even been some studies that show that different kinds of drones, depending on how the network is built, the drones can potentially be the lowest carbon impact because of they're moving so little weight in the vehicle because they're so light. And it gets weirder the more you look into it. There was a patent that was revealed a couple of years ago. I guess the newspaper in Seattle found it when they were doing some digging on Amazon. And it was essentially a warehouse built into a blimp that Amazon had patented. And the idea, it was never built, but the idea was that they would park it either over sporting events or over neighborhoods during the shopping season, load it up with very popular items, and essentially have a bunch of drones that would glide down into the neighborhood for deliveries when people ordered the items.
All right, I have to jump in here. My guest is Anthony M. Townsend. His new book is Ghost Road, Beyond the Driverless Car. We'll be right back. Chris Boyd speaking this hour with author Anthony M. Townsend, who is founder of the Star City Group Strategy Consultancy and author of a new book called Ghost Road, Beyond the Driverless Car. Before the break, Anthony, we're talking about this blimp warehouse that was at least conceived to circle above populated areas, deliver things down. That makes me think about, you know, the ways that our choices are not technically limited, but limited by the fact of what's in the blimp, right? We might want to choose a different item, but if we find that we can have it in 10 minutes, that's how we're going to choose.
Yeah. So I think the point I was getting at is that almost any way that we could deliver stuff to our homes would be less carbon intensive than getting into our 2-ton automobiles and driving through a shopping center. And so if all automated delivery means and a shift to e-commerce is that we're changing the way we move those boxes to our homes and do it in this more efficient way, then that's a good thing. But what happens is, and this is something I talk about in the book, it's called the Jevons paradox or the rebound effect. It's very well known in conservation economics, that when we make our resource more, the production more efficient, people actually consume more of it. So this is what we've seen, you know, with like air conditioning and refrigeration, that by making those machines more efficient, we don't reduce the energy that's consumed for air conditioning or refrigeration. We just, you know, increase demand for air conditioning because it's cheaper. People tend to cool their homes at much lower temperatures than they used to. This is something that's very well known. So, you know, what I argue in the book is that a lot of what we're seeing in these various internet-enabled retail environments that people call by different names, like the shared economy and the on-demand economy, is consumption that never would have happened unless you had this very efficient system for delivering stuff to people's homes. And so we really need to watch that and pay more attention to some other models that are starting to emerge, out of the sustainability movement, like circular economies. So I'm excited when I think about what automated delivery vehicles might allow us to do in terms of local food production. So instead of bringing you the shoes from Zappos and taking the ones you don't want back, could we put that infrastructure and that technology to work, you know, delivering locally grown food products and taking the organic waste, the compost, back to the farm. There's a lot of details to be worked out to make something like that reality, but I think it's a different vision for thinking about what the technology might be used for that can give cities and communities and everyday people just a different thing to aspire to. As they think about what this could offer.
I'm honestly not sure where I got this idea, but when I imagine, 20 years out in the future when autonomous vehicles are everywhere, for some reason I've always pictured like just a whole bunch of identical Jetsons looking bubbles rolling around. In fact, you think we will specialize vehicles more than anything we've imagined in the past.
Yeah, I think that's the big difference between this technology and the market for particularly urban mobility today and where it was 100 years ago when the automobile came on the scene. The automobile hasn't changed very much in the last 100 years. It's a quite inflexible technology and inflexible product. And we've really built our world around it. This technology is totally different. All of the pieces that go into it are modular. Electric motors can be really small or really big. You can build an automated vehicle that does one thing with one sensor. Maybe it just can drive to the corner and back and do something. Or you can build one with a supercomputer and 50 sensors that can drive down an interstate highway. They're programmable. They are so programmable, in fact, that they can learn. and they can even teach themselves and they can teach each other. The whole concept of fleet learning, which is how Tesla has managed to speed ahead so fast, is that its vehicles are constantly sharing insights about, I have detected this new kind of road construction marking. I'm going to teach the entire fleet about this during the nightly update. And so this makes them particularly well suited to the challenges of urban mobility, because people moving around cities or businesses trying to move freight around cities tend to have very specialized needs. I wrote about a company in the book in New York City called Pet Chauffeur. All they do is move animals around the city. They have on more than one occasion had to, move a leopard around Manhattan. So they have specialized techniques and equipment for moving really large cats. I don't know if someone's going to make an automated vehicle for moving a cat around, but there will probably be, automated pet carriers. And I think that is very much in sync with the way that the whole market for technology and the internet and the economy in general has been moving, is that when you need to solve a problem, you buy the thing or the service that solves that problem. You don't buy this giant thing that you're going to own for 10 years that is trying to solve 1,000 different problems and solving all of them sort of halfway, which is what a car does.
For all the hazards that we worry about police encountering in their daily jobs, a lot of people don't realize that one of the most dangerous things they might be called on to do is direct traffic when a light is out or an accident has happened. Can you explain a street steward and how that could work?
Yeah, I think that there's an opportunity to replace a lot of the furniture. What urban planners call street furniture, that's like parking meters and lights and signs, with automated vehicles that are basically robots that can move around, and they can measure things, which parking spaces are occupied, how much traffic is there, where are the people, and in a much more agile way, reallocate the space of the street to better address the needs of the city at the time, and reduce the level of manpower that's needed. So we have actually, the book is full of drawings. Mm-hmm. This is my second book, and I realized that a picture really is worth 1,000 words. So I wrote about 10,000 fewer words, and I put 10 pages worth of pictures in there. And so we call these things urban ushers. These are essentially robots who help, tend to the flocks of people and vehicles moving through cities. And they'll be able to do things like dynamically close streets, implement congestion pricing for both tolling of road access as well as parking. And that will allow cities to recoup some of the value of the streets. And they can use that for transit or parks or other things that benefit people. They could be used in evacuations to give people information. They could be used right now to do things like remind or enforce social distancing requirements. I think what's interesting to me is that while the book is primarily about automated vehicles, really using cars as like the starting point, the lines between what's an automated vehicle and what's a robot as you go smaller, and what's an automated vehicle and what's like a mobile building, really start to get blurry the closer you look at it. I think between automotive engineering and architecture and robotics, we're going to start to see a lot of crossovers that really challenge our notions of what those things are.
You introduced a term here that I don't think I'd heard before, which is mobility as a service. What does that mean?
So mobility as a service is kind of a bit of industry jargon, and it's really trying to describe a world in which all of the different transportation systems work together inside your phone. I think that's the simplest way to understand it. And that if, you know, in the same way that you can fire up Google Maps or Apple Maps or Transit app or any of a million apps and plan your trip, and it'll tell you, okay, to get from point A to point B, you can take this bus, walk this far, hop on this bike share, and then ride the bike, you know, to the end of your trip. Mobility as a service is the stuff in the background that allows you to go in and see the prices for each of those, and then actually buy one ticket for one price and show it on your phone that lets you do all that. That's very difficult to do now, except in a handful of places in the world. And what's great about that is that that is going to tie together all of the different pieces of the transportation system that aren't cars and make them as easy to use and as convenient and as door-to-door as cars are. And automated vehicles are going to be a huge part of making that happen, because they'll be able to push their status and their location and their availability into that system. And really, it's about making the transportation system customer focused rather than something that's kind of like, you know, a government service or like the post office, like stand in line, you know, and wait for it to arrive.
Everybody's heard of mass transit. What is micro transit?
Micro transit is really what the name implies, it's sort of taking mass transit and breaking it down into smaller pieces, smaller vehicles that typically are not operating on fixed routes and fixed schedules, but are more on demand. So one of the more exciting types of automated vehicles that I write about quite at length, because I think they're really quite new and could really be transformative, are what are called driverless shuttles. And these are basically mini buses. They carry, you know, anywhere from 8 to 12 people. There's three now. But the two most popular ones are actually made by French companies, and they look kind of like ski gondolas, that are on wheels. And, the idea is that, in a neighborhood, in a city, they would constantly be taking requests from people who wanted to go places, figuring out what's the best route to pick everybody up, and then dropping people off along the way, and that the route would sort of be changing along the way. It's very high tech, very futuristic, you know, totally driverless, totally internet app driven. But what's interesting about it is that that's exactly the way that what they call informal transit works in many megacities in the developing world. So if you go to the Philippines or Mexico City, you basically have the same thing, but the way you hail it is by, you know, raising your hand at the side of the road, and the driver sort of works out all the pickups and drop-offs. So it's interesting that, you know, this innovation is kind of working its way back into our world through high tech, but it works.
This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. All right, we have an email here from William who wants to know, who is financially responsible when a driverless car crashes?
That's a great question. We don't know yet. I'm not a legal expert, and there are some very complex legal questions involved here. I honestly think that the best answer is that it's not going to be any different than when a human-driven car crashes. So, you know, right now there's a lot of equipment between your hands and the road. There's already lots of software in there. You know, very few cars today have a direct physical linkage between your hands and the wheel. So there's product liability law involved. I think it depends, you know, whether you're renting the car or you own it, whether you're working or you're on your own time. So I think most of the questions about, you know, who's on the hook when things go wrong with automated vehicles aren't going to change that much, you know, when there's a human operator involved. And the truth is that most of the time, there is going to be an operator. You know, we talk about driverlessness as if it's like a binary switch from fully human-driven to fully computer-driven. And in fact, I think for most of our lifetimes going forward, it's going to be much more of a sort of gray zone as we go through these various stages of partial automation.
One of the things you note is that a lot of people who have driving as a component of their jobs also do something else. So there are, you know, paramedics who drive to the scene, but they're also, you know, taking care of people. There are folks who, you know, show up at your house and fix your fridge when it breaks down. Driving won't disappear as a function of people's jobs.
Yeah, and even most professional drivers or people who drive as part of their job, like the ones you described, do other things than operate the vehicle or even conduct the vehicle down the road while they're driving. You know, they may be monitoring fuel or checking on passengers or, you know, monitoring stock or cargo. They may be making repairs or planning journeys. So, you know, physically guiding the vehicle safely down the road is an important critical part of operating a motor vehicle, but it's only one tiny part, and there's so many other pieces. And I think where we're going to see these professional driving jobs go is that employers are going to say, great, we freed up that really time-consuming task that added so little value to that person's job in our business. Now we can have them do stuff that really makes us money. And they're going to try to retrain and upskill those workers and find ways to make more use of them. I did a lot of thinking in the public sector, you know, for instance, in public transit, like on a city bus. City buses are really the front line potentially for all kinds of low-cost interventions for people who, you know, senior citizens who, you know, need care, who need to be looked after. Are they taking their medications? Are early signs of dementia? Can we do screenings? Are they getting to their doctor's appointments? You know, mothers, children, are they getting to school? There's so many ways that we could rethink how we engage people rather than just training someone to operate a large vehicle.
My guest,
a computer can do it.
My guest is Anthony M. Townsend. We're talking about his new book, Ghost Road, Beyond the Driverless Car. We'll be back in 2 minutes. Chris Boyd, my guest this hour, is founder of the Star City Group strategy consultancy, Anthony M. Townsend, who's written a book called Ghost Road, Beyond the Driverless Car. Let's take a phone call. We have Maggie on the line in Fort Worth, Texas. Hi, Maggie.
Hello.
Hi.
I've been an adopter of a lot of this new technology for a long time. I joined Amazon in 1996. But that said, there's a lot to be said for the post office as a physical location and something that is not hackable. I think that a lot of these things you're describing are part of that Internet of Things, and I wonder at how the danger of interference is addressed.
Thank you for your call.
Yeah, I think post offices and postal systems in general have a very important part to play in this future of online retailing, particularly as a counterweight to companies like Amazon and even Walmart that haven't, you know, that potentially are in a position to monopolize that, what they call in the industry, the last mile delivery, which is it's usually more than a mile, in particularly in the US, between the local distribution center and your home. You know, the U.S. Postal Service, because it's always held on such a short leash by the government, hasn't been able to really make a strong play. But I think it's going to have to soon, or it's going to become irrelevant. And I think you know, the consequences of not having a strong postal system with a strong distribution network means that Amazon will be able to do the kinds of things that it does in its online marketplace, which is it is both the owner of the marketplace and a direct competitor with the small businesses that it invites to come in and sell there. So Amazon, this is very well documented, will routinely go in and find, you know, the companies that are killing it with a new product, say, you know, a stand for a laptop. I don't know if anybody who's doing Zooms now has figured out that, you know, you want your laptop camera to be a little bit higher up so it's not looking at the bottom of your chin, right? So everybody wants this. Amazon sees these things are selling like hotcakes. Well, they go in and they knock that product off, and because they have access to all the customer data from these small businesses doing business in the marketplace, they can just clobber them, and they have this incredibly unfair advantage. Well, they're going to start doing that now to small businesses in your town. And I think the postal system is one potential way to push back on that, because it provides these small businesses another distribution channel. They won't have to go through Amazon to get packages to your door. So I think security, yeah, having a physical place to go, you know, that isn't necessarily connected to the internet is important. But I think getting the postal service connected to the internet in a 21st century way is also going to be super important, because we need to balance this very strong economic force.
All right. As a thought exercise, let's fast forward to whatever time it will be when all or most motor vehicles can be safely and effectively operated by artificial intelligence. How might that change the way cities are laid out and where things happen within cities?
Yeah, I mean, I think we're definitely going to see city centers continue to become, you know, we'll have more exclusions of more types of car-like things. It'll be harder and harder to drive a car into a city center. And eventually that'll even extend to automated vehicles. You're going to see a lot more stuff going on around the clock. So not necessarily about the layout of the city, but the choreography and the scheduling. You know, if I were in charge, almost all freight would move at night, because there's no reason, once it's automated, to move it during the daytime. You don't save any money, and you're taking away valuable space for people to walk and cycle and you know, now dine in the daytime. I think we'll see new forms of transit that will allow us to, explore new kinds of densities. What's really interesting about right now is that I think we're going to start reexamining some of the assumptions about what's good density and what's maybe too much density. That 6 months ago, we thought more density was going to be better for a lot of reasons. We may be second guessing that now. I think these technologies will give us flexibility, you know, maybe less trains, more microtransit, you know, less shared taxis, more self-driving scooters and bikes that can take themselves not just to the charging point between riders, but to the disinfection station as well. And so instead of thinking of walkable neighborhoods, thinking about scootable and bikeable neighborhoods. So I think it's really, you know, I think the exciting thing is the flexibility that these will provide, which is all about, you know, the real specialization that the technology allows.
I tend to see mostly younger folks using scooters. Right now, they're driven by the driver, but theoretically they could be automated. But will we see kinds of vehicles that will be for single use only and maybe available to borrow rather than own, but that work to make people who have a small child with them, or people who have different needs and don't feel comfortable scooting through a city?
Absolutely. I mean, I think it's possible that the breakthrough self-driving vehicle is a self-driving wheelchair. Hitachi right now, which is the largest maker of motorized wheelchairs in the world, has been prototyping a self-driving wheelchair, and they're testing it in airports because they see this as a huge step forward in terms of independent mobility for people who are wheelchair bound. You know, one of the big questions about automated vehicles has been, who's going to pay for all this? And in the last decade, we've seen health insurers and national health systems have stepped up to pay for motorized wheelchairs for hundreds of millions of people around the world, because the social benefits of giving those people independence and continuing to live productive lives is just enormous. And so, you know, that may be how this technology actually gets out into the world, is when it finds, you know, this killer application.
What happens to our opportunities for incidental exercise in a world of incredibly convenient, omnipresent autonomous vehicles?
Yeah, I mean, that's the big risk. You know, if you look at some of the predictions of like what might happen to the inside of automobiles once they become so automated that the controls disappear, it basically just becomes a really luxurious extension of the living room. Wrap around screens. Disney has a group that's working on what the completely immersive media and entertainment experience of that environment might be. And you just have to look at who are the companies that are pursuing this technology most aggressively. They're all search engine companies: Google, Baidu in China, Yandex, the Russian search engine, because they see this as literally a computer that you climb inside of. This is what the mobile phone was 10 years ago. It's the next big computing platform, and they want to have control of that screen. That is potentially a real nightmare. You also have the economists who are looking at this as a potential productivity boost, right? All of the time we spend wasted in traffic, which in the US is hundreds of billions of dollars a year, could become productive time. That is time that we are not spending walking, climbing stairs, doing other kinds of active things in the world that we could, be burning calories and stretching our muscles. So it is a real risk. The self-driving wheelchair thing is a screenshot right out of WALL-E. Right. People moving around in hover chairs with the screen right in front of their face. All I can say is, I think from urban planning point of view, more mobility means people have more access to each other. And potentially when they get to where they're going, I would expect that they'll be doing active things and they'll be engaging in experiences that, we can't even imagine. There weren't rock climbing walls in every city in North America 10 years ago. We don't know what people will be going out in self-driving cars together to do 10 years from now. But I think, giving them the mobility to gather will allow them to discover those things.
This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. We have an email here from John, who writes, in the suburbs of Phoenix, where they're testing driverless cars, there have been incidents where people attacked the cars because they were upset about bad lane changes and that sort of thing. People obviously don't like change. How can companies build trust that autonomous vehicles are not dangerous or unnecessary?
I think this is going to be a huge obstacle. Most of the people in the industry that I talk to are convinced that exposure is going to really erode those fears and those reactions quite quickly. I think it's a reasonable expectation. On the other hand, we have seen all kinds of things this year that have been quite shocking. There was a number of incidents in the UK at the beginning of the COVID outbreak of sabotage against 5G cell phone towers because there were purported linkages to the outbreak of the 5G signals. We've had these just lingering politicization of mask wearing. There are illogical and counterfactual kind of reactions to things that are like established. And this technology, that's why I chose this title Ghost Road, because it is scary. It is supernatural. It's going to be our first close encounter with artificial intelligence in a physical container, a physical form that's big enough to kill us. This is going to be more than serving us, political ads and doing shadowy things behind our screens. And while it has the potential to deliver huge benefits, I mean, I dedicated this book to my uncle who died, you know, 10 years before I was born in an automobile accident. It is going to save many, many lives, but it also has the potential to rearrange the world in ways that people find very, very threatening, and will be challenging for them to understand. You know, the industry challenge is just going to be really patient and repeatedly explain to people the things that are tough to swallow.
If we don't own our own means of transportation, and I'll stipulate that I recognize that not everyone does right now, I wonder how this technology could be used to limit mobility of people. Say, you don't belong in this neighborhood. You shouldn't do this thing. You don't have enough money to be in this shopping center or whatever.
Yeah, I mean, it's very easy to identify groups that don't fit into the future. The unbanked are going to have a very hard time gaining access to automated vehicles. People who don't have a digital identity that, you know, is valid in the various clouds that will govern. You know, the last third of the book really looks at what happens when Google and Amazon and Apple and, you know, whoever's left standing really hold the keys to mobility. And, you know, there's a couple of ways to think about it. One way to think about it is like, you can't back out of your driveway unless, you know, you pay these guys a fee because they're the gatekeepers. Or, you know, nothing moves on the planet unless they get a cut because they're tracking it all and they're in control of it. You know, you'll have to have an account. And if you don't have an account, you won't get access. And there really won't be any kind of appeal. And I think those kinds of futures, again, we've seen this happen online and all of the inconveniences and injustices and biases. Now mapping that into the physical world where it's controlling the movement of our bodies and essential goods, and it starts to become really, really problematic.
Do you feel like lawmakers and urban planners get what's coming?
I don't think they're prepared. It's the main reason I wrote the book. I think that with respect to this issue of corporate control and the potential for monopolies in automated mobility, I think the potential for an Enron-type character to emerge is very, very real. And we're really unprepared for it. I think, you know, Uber did not play well with cities, but cities didn't really learn how to guard against that happening again. And I think the next one will be far worse.
Anthony M. Townsend is founder of the Star City Group and author of the book Ghost Road, Beyond the Driverless Car. Anthony, thank you for spending this hour with us.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.
You can like our page on Facebook. We're on Twitter at KERA Think. We hope that you'll subscribe to the KERA Think podcast. And you can always listen on our website, think.kera.org. Again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.